This Coin Week podcast is brought to you by PCGS. PCGS is the standard in the rare coin grading industry. Visit PCGS.com to learn more. In this Coin Week podcast, we talk to Farron Zerbe Award winner Don Perlman. Don is a former governor of the American Numismatic Association and has spent much of his numismatic career publicizing important events in the numismatic hobby. Hi there, Don. This is Charles Morgan from Coin Week. How are you doing?
Hello, Charles. Good to talk with you again.
So I was batting around ideas of people I wanted to talk to bring out a little bit of personality in numismatics. We often think about coin collecting as an individual pursuit. You have a person and the coins, and you know how collectors can be a little squirrely about that. But in reality, the numismatic hobby and industry is a fraternity and sorority of different personalities. We often see each other quite a bit as we travel around the country, and I don't know too many people in coins today that are quite as much of a character as you are. You're probably one of the most entertaining individuals I know in the hobby.
I take that as a compliment. Thank you.
So what is it about coins that gives you such an upbeat spirit that makes you the Don Perlman we know, irreverent, funny, and layered in meaning?
Well, it's kind of interesting. As a child, I was rather shy, but then I started doing dressing up as a clown and doing magic at the kids' birthday parties and worked my way through high school doing that. And when you're wearing clown makeup, there's a wall there. You can do anything you want to, and you're hiding behind that wall of clown makeup. I went into broadcasting, and an early mentor of mine gave me some very good advice. He said, take your work seriously, but not yourself. And that's kind of my outlook on life. So I like to have some fun, but when it comes time to work, then you roll up the sleeves and get the work done.
Yeah, but numismatics is fun, and you make it seem fun, especially to the mainstream audience.
Well, it should be fun. You know, everyone has a latent interest in money, and when you call up a reporter or an editor or a blogger and say, I've got a story idea about a $3 million nickel. People's eyes open up wide. Oh, tell me more. Tell me more. And you may not be able to afford a $3 million nickel, but it's fun to read about it and learn about it. And the fascinating stories about every piece of paper money, every coin ever produced, has a story to tell about people, places, and events. And it's an interesting, fun job, but it's also a hobby to enjoy.
So let's talk about your role in bringing the 1913 Walton nickel out of the woodwork.
For a number of years, I've assisted the American Numismatic Association with publicity in the local communities where they have their annual conventions, the National Money Show and the World's Fair of Money. And in early 2003, I had been told that at least one of the famous 1913 Liberty Head nickels would be on display at the World's Fair of Money in the summer of 2003 in Baltimore, Maryland. Then I was, about a month later, having a discussion with Beth Deischer, who was the editor at that time of Coin World, and she had mentioned, she asked me, she said, what do you have planned for publicity for the World's Fair of Money? And I said, surviving nickels together to be on display at that show, because it's just outside Washington, and one of the coins is at the Smithsonian. So I immediately picked up my cell phone and called Dwight Manley, who owned one of the 1913 Liberty Nickels. He immediately committed to having it on display at the Baltimore show. So now we've got two. Beth is going to work on getting the one from the Smithsonian, so that would be three. And I made some calls, and we got the fourth nickel, and we suddenly had four of the five coins. The fifth one had been missing since the 1960s. Believed lost in a car crash by George O. Walton, who was on his way to a coin show when he was killed in a car wreck. About a month later, I had this idea for a publicity stunt. Why not offer a reward for the missing nickel and have it on display at the convention and all five could be reunited? And one thing led to another, and Collectors Universe, had they agreed to back up a $1 million reward or $1 million advance to consign the coin to an auction. And Associated Press broke the story on Memorial Day weekend of 2003, and it got picked up everywhere. And suddenly there was this nationwide, worldwide hunt for the missing coin. And one thing led to another, and with the assistance of Beth Deischer and others, contact was made with the heirs of George Walton. They made arrangements to bring the coin to the Baltimore Convention. Collectors Universe agreed to pay $10,000 to be the first just to see the missing fifth coin. There was a secret midnight meeting in the security room at the Baltimore Convention Center, where all five coins were together for the first time in over 60 years. And the experts looked at them side by side and took a vote amongst themselves, and it was unanimous. This was the long-missing coin. I had a two-week-old digital camera, my very first digital camera, and I wanted to get a picture of the Walton nickel outside of the custom-made capital plastic holder that it had resided in for decades. And I had about 30 seconds to do it because the security guards wanted to clear the security room and get everybody out of there. I only shot the obverse because if you look at an obverse of a 1913 Liberty nickel, you know immediately what it is. It wasn't right. Until the next morning when I was talking with Fred Weinberg, one of the experts who was a part of the examination and authentication team that night. I said, what were the diagnostics? And he told me, primarily on the reverse. Ear of corn, on the left side, was lightly struck on all five specimens. That was one of the key diagnostics. But I had only shot the obverse. But for 2 weeks, that was the only photograph available of the Walton nickel outside of the capital plastic holder. And that got picked up by Associated Press and other places. And I'm very proud of that photograph. Only had 2 weeks to work with that digital camera and 30 seconds to take the picture.
So Walton died in the car crash in 1962, and his heirs had the coin. Why do you think it took so long for his family to realize that they had the 1913 nickel all along?
That was an interesting question that I asked during the half hour or so while the experts were locked inside the security room at the Baltimore Convention Center and examining each of the five coins. I sat with two of the Walton heirs, brother and sister, whose mother was George Walton's brother. And I said, where's the coin been all this time? And it was for many years, for decades, it was literally in a closet, in a strong box with other family papers and other items. And then it was moved to a nightstand. And over the years, when a 1913 Liberty nickel would be sold, Ryan Givens, one of George Walton's nephews, would take out the coin and hold it up to the newspaper article and try and compare it. And he says, well, they look the same, but the experts know that this one's a fake. Why didn't they throw it out? Well, their mother was born in 1913, so it was a keepsake for the year she was born. And she said, my brother George would never lie. If he said he had a 1913 Liberty nickel, he had a 1913 Liberty nickel, and it's somewhere. And they kept the coin. They had consigned, the heirs had consigned George Walton's remaining coin collection for an auction that was held in 1963. And at the time, it brought the most money ever for a rare coin auction, over $800,000. But three coins were sent back, and this is one of them. And if you look closely at the Walton nickel, look at pictures of it and enlarge the pictures, under the three, there's a planchet defect. On all five of the known 1913 Liberty nickels, there is a planchet defect somewhere. And it just so happens, through the luck of the strike, the planchet defect is under the three in 1913 on the Walton specimen. And so it looks suspicious. It looks like, is it an altered date? Is it some kind of a counterfeit? Was it retooling? What happened here? Well, it was just a planchet defect. But in 1962 and 1963, we didn't have as much knowledge about striking and 1913 Nichols, and people who looked at it at that time thought it was suspicious and labeled it a fake, incorrectly. So it would have been a $25,000 or so coin at auction in 1963. Fast forward to 2013, when Heritage Auctions offered it, it brought over $3 million for the Walton Heirs.
Well, it's understandable that these coins might have quality control issues, seeing that they weren't officially made.
ANA Money Museum curator Doug Mudd, when he does interviews about the 1913 Nichols, usually starts out with, "It was a dark and stormy night at the Philadelphia Mint."
Yeah.
Yes, there was. Yes, there was money to be made for the worker striking the coin. You know, it's amazing when you think about this 1913 Nichols story. But did you ever imagine when you were a kid, first getting your start in the hobby, that you would be handling these iconic treasures and being so integrally involved in their conveyance?
I'm the luckiest collector in the world. I cannot afford some of these great rarities, but I've had the absolute privilege of holding in my hand four of the five 1913 Liberty of Nichols, several 1804 dollars, the finest known 1794 silver dollar, believed by many experts to be the very first one struck by the mint, the King of Siam proof set, and many other just absolutely wonderful pieces of numismatic treasure.
So were the guards at Sachs Bowers looking at you all cross when you were handling that 1822 $5 coin? Because I tell you, when I went to shoot the video of that coin for Coin Week, they didn't trust me. And the Sachs folks were very comfortable and familiar with me. And we were all right there together. And I had all this professional equipment on me. And they hovered like hawks every second I handled that coin.
The security guards correctly get paid to be suspicious and keep a close eye on the merchandise.
I feel the same way as you do about my role in the hobby. I started with a Red Book as a fan of coins, and now I travel the country, meet collectors and dealers, share in the community, take in many great rarities. It's an unbelievable life when you think about it. And sometimes it's difficult to convey to collectors how this hobby is a community of some of the most interesting people that you'll run into, and that it's all there for you to take in as well.
I'm very lucky in that I've been able to personally examine and hold some of these great numismatic treasures, but I also get excited when I find something in circulation. Recently, I live in Las Vegas, and recently at one of the hotels in change, I got a 1943S war nickel, a silver war nickel. And I thought, wow, I made 20 times my money in Vegas. I mean, because of the silver content. But I think to myself, where has this coin been? Did someone break open a piggy bank because they needed some money? Did someone pass away and the heirs didn't know that this was a coin worth more than face value and then they spent it? This coin has a history because they had to use the nickel for the war efforts in 1943, so they made the nickels out of silver. I still get quite excited when I find things like that.
Don, you've written countless articles and press releases. You've been a journalist in the trade. Where do you think we are now in terms of writing in this hobby?
I think a half century or century from now, people will look back at the 1990s and into the 2000s as a golden age of numismatics in the United States for a couple of reasons. One, it was the 50 state quarters program that got people looking at their pocket change, and the Mint estimated at one point that there were, I believe, over 120 million people collecting the coins, and if even only a half percent of them went on to become collectors of other coins, that's a huge increase in collecting. And also, there's been an explosion in numismatic knowledge. The researchers have published more books. There's more information available with a few taps on the keyboard of a computer or a smartphone with information online. And again, I think that they'll look back and see this as part of a golden age of numismatics. that so much was available to the public in information as well as collecting enjoyment.
I also look at the landscape and I see headwinds. For starters, there's going to be a shift if it hasn't reached critical mass at will, where digital will replace print and be the primary way people get information in this hobby. And I'll say on the journalism side, as someone who edits and publishes a for-profit news and information periodical, it's difficult to be in a trade where you are solely dependent on ad revenue and write about the people who are paying you in a critical and non-biased way. You know, we do our best not to be affected by it, but we are looking at an industry that is in dire need of some critical reform. And nobody seems to be willing or able to write about or think about things that could be done to help the hobby. Case in point. I went to a Mint Directors Conference in Bangkok in May and gave a strongly worded presentation to the mints that told them that the volume of products that each mint puts out is too much for the secondary market, which is made up of small private businesses to prop up, and that the capital that would be required to prop up the premiums that the mints charge for their mountains of new coins just isn't there. There's just too many coins. And I'm not suggesting that the U.S. Mint is the most egregious actor in this postmodern coin scene, because it's really not. But the mints have no interest or desire to be involved in the secondary market. They say, we are making coins for the fun of it, not as investments. And I guess that's okay, except that so much of our industry relies on the idea that coin collecting is also investing, and that collectors will receive some remuneration for their active participation in the market. Yet, I see silence when it comes to numismatic publications that cover the news when it comes to the realities of the marketplace. That there really are no bids for this type of material, that Silver Eagles might sell for tens of thousands at auction, but that dealers have no desire to stock this material, and that all the novelty and limited edition programs that are developed to sell these coins add no real value to the coins in the long run. But nobody wants to write about these things. So while we may be in a golden age of information, we're not in a golden age of coin journalism. And I wonder if there ever was a period where collectors were getting real, actionable, and honest information from their trade periodicals.
You brought up a good point regarding the mint, and this concerns me quite a bit. A couple of mints have indicated that their commemorative coins that they produce are legal tender, but yet they're not really legal tender. You cannot take them to the bank. The banks don't have to redeem them. In some cases, right, it's extremely difficult to redeem the coins for face value. And I think there's a huge credibility issue that's going to explode. If the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times ever did a story about that, that coins from some of these countries that people in the U.S. and elsewhere are buying are not even worth the face value, that could be a problem, a huge problem. And it would not just affect the modern commemorative coins being produced by that country, it could affect all of numismatics because it would undermine the credibility.
Well, we essentially ran into that problem with the Franklin Mint in the 1970s.
Well, the Franklin Mint did produce beautiful items. They charged a good premium for the product. And it's funny because before the big run-up in silver, the 60 Minutes program did an expose about the Franklin Mint charging $10, and silver was only $1 or $2. And it looked terrible. But then you fast forward to early 1980, and suddenly silver is $50 an ounce, and that $10 investment you made really looks good right now. So it's a matter of perspective.
But that took a historic run-up in order to turn that investment into a good thing. So it was luck.
And if people go in and are buying something, whether it's a coin or a Pez dispenser or an old comic book, they should first be buying it because they enjoy it, whether it's historic value or they just think it's pretty. The monetary compensation when it comes time to sell should not be the primary concern. yes, you can make money with numismatics, but enjoy the appreciation of the item itself while hopefully it appreciates in value later.
I'm a big reader of, and I consider it its own genre, of trashy numismatic literature of the 60s, 70s, and 80s. The books that are really investment heavy, make money on coins, more tips to make money on coins, because it gets to the core of how coins are sold and marketed.
I'm still waiting for the hyperinflation and the $3,000 gold that's been touted for decades.
Well, you don't have to look far for opinions on when that'll happen. You just have to wait a long time to see it actually come to fruition. No, but one of the things that strikes me, and I'm not trying to throw anybody under the bus, but as we get into incremental grading and major steps in value that come from each different tick on the grading scale, that we've gentrified the coin market. And yes, you'd have your traditional collector that would put coins together, buy whatever they could afford. If they wanted uncirculating coins, they'd pay for them. If they wanted nicer uncirculated coins, they'd pay more for those. But we went from that model to a model where a 64 had more value than a 63, and a 65 had more value than a 64. And we set a line of demarcation that said 65 was a desirable grade for an investor, and that grades above 65 were scarce and rare and ultra valuable because of it. And because of this mania and the newness of incremental grading, we saw prices go to extraordinary levels where someone would actually be willing to pay $1,000 for not just one 1881 S Morgan and MS65, but for boxes of them. And today that coin sells for about $50. And I don't even adjust that $1,000 for inflation. And if you did, you're now into that coin for about $2,200 or more each. And it seems to me that when we look at the way the coin market has developed, you have to understand that a lot of the infrastructure we have is investment driven. It's baked into the pie, and we can't escape it. And that's part of the problem when we talk about the coin market and prices and ups and downs. The big question is, where are new collectors today? But we basically alienated a whole generation of collectors by shutting them out, by turning a $20 Morgan dollar into a $1,000 coin. And now you can buy it for $100 or less. But where is the association for these new collectors? They didn't grow up on classic coins because they couldn't afford them. So they grew up collecting modern coins. So now we have a bifurcated coin market. Younger collectors are collecting modern coins. Older collectors are collecting what they consider traditional coins. And there seems to be a gap between the two types of collectors, and it's something this industry is going to have to resolve in the years to come.
Yeah, I think there's also an education problem. The general public, now the state quarters program was fabulous. Got a lot of people collecting. The America the Beautiful program is ambitious and wonderful, but I don't think it's anywhere near as successful in terms of the numbers of collectors as we had with the 50 state quarters program back in the late 90s and early 2000s. The people, though, see on television or see online or hear on the radio, read in the newspaper, that a nickel is sold for $3 million. And that's probably may encourage them to look in their piggy bank and check their sock drawer to see if they have one, but it's not going to prompt them to go out to the local coin dealer or look up online and start collecting coins. At the ANA National Money Show this past March in Dallas, a couple of convention halls down from where the ANA show was, there was a convention of people who liked the zombie genre of science fiction. And they were all dressed up in costumes and doing the Walking Dead thing. And there were huge lines to get in every day. And someone said to me, how do we get big lines like that into the coin show? And I said, convince Hollywood to start making movies and television programs about coin collecting. Just as they make the shows about zombies. I said, that will get people to line up at the coin show.
Well, what did the Hawaii 5-0 segment on that 1913 nickel do for the market? Did it have an impact on that coin?
I'm told by the people who were around at that time, and that was It was the 1970s. I can't remember exactly what year that was, but the episode was called The $100,000 Nickel. Well, today it's a multi-million dollar nickel. But it did spark some interest in people calling to say, I have a 1912 nickel. Is that worth more money because it's a year older? Like, for example, in promoting a coin show, I've learned over the years that you don't want, for the general public, the promotion to break too early because you can't sustain it. It's not like a Tom Cruise movie that has a $50 million marketing and advertising budget where you can have things start 6 months before the movie premieres. So the optimum to promote a coin show is 1 or 2 weeks out for the community in which that show is located. We don't have the California Raisin people have a California Raisin Marketing Board that sells raisins. There's a Wisconsin dairy board that promotes milk and butter and cheese. And numismatics does not really have a marketing council. It would take a lot of money. It would take coordination. And if you want to get the general public to have the enjoyment of coin collecting before them on an almost daily basis or a weekly or even monthly basis, you need to do some marketing.
Don, where will your next appearance at a coin show be?
My next scheduled appearance at a coin show will be the American Numismatic Association World Fair of Money and the PNG ANA Numismatic Trade Show, and those will be held starting August the 8th at the Anaheim Convention Center.
And what will the big exhibits be at the ANA?
Well, there's a couple of things. One of the public favorites is always the Bureau of Engraving and Printing's billion-dollar display that features high-denomination currency, including $100,000 bills. Monaco rare coins from Newport Beach will have the first public display of a magnificent $8 million collection of Type 1 Double Eagles, a 46-coin set put together by a collector who wants to remain anonymous but wants to show these coins for the first time in person. There are a number of other displays of the museum showcase that the ANA produces through the ANA Museum. Items from the Aubrey and Adeline Beebe currency collection that's housed at the ANA Money Museum in Colorado Springs. And I like to tell people that an ANA convention has a little of everything. There are items priced from less than a dollar to more than $1 million each and everything in between. And it's a great place for beginners as well as advanced collectors.
And you'll get a chance to meet and say hi to the incomparable Don Perlman.
Thank you, Charles. Always a pleasure. I will see you in Anaheim.
All right, Don. I appreciate you stopping by. If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends. And remember, you can download all of Coin Week's podcasts for free from the iTunes Store. For Coin Week, I'm Editor Charles Morgan, signing off. Happy collecting.